Today is Friday, March 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's the legacy of Tanzania's President John Pombe Magufuli?
His opponents would always criticize him as a person who they think violated human rights, but the majority of the masses thinks he was their leader.
Plus, the first of a series of diplomatic meetings aimed at establishing peace in Afghanistan. And the United Nations lauds its vaccine rollout. We'll have these stories and more next. Tanzania's late president, John Pombe Magufuli, was a controversial politician and once condemned as a dictator, yet popular as an economic nationalist. To better understand his conflicting legacy in the context of Tanzania's broader history, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to Sabato Niamsenda at the Political Science Department of the University of Dar es Salaam.
He leaves behind a mixed legacy. His opponents would always criticize him as a person who they think violated human rights and narrowed the political space. But the majority of the masses thinks he was their leader as an anti-imperialist leader, a resource nationalist who stood firmly against corruption and insisted on effective use of state resources, tried to nationalize some of the strategic enterprises to put them under state ownership. So he leaves behind a mixed legacy, and it depends on which class one belongs to when analyzing his legacy.
And I'd love to get into that mixed legacy as you described. Can we first look at the side that viewed him very negatively, the views of opposition members and others who criticized his human rights record?
It's very obvious when he got into power in 2015, there has been almost a consistent narrowing of the political space in Tanzania. For instance, he limited the political activity of political parties. He banned public rallies until elections. He tried to limit the operating space for civil society organizations, especially NGOs that are funded by Western governments and agencies. There was also a restriction on media freedom and generally on the right to the freedom of expression. In my own analysis, I think this problem is more systemic and historical rather than a misrule of an individual. Some of the laws that he used to crack down on the civil society and the freedom of expression, for instance, were enacted by his predecessors. By saying that, I'm not trying to deny his role specifically, but I'm saying we simply need to go beyond him. Because to me, the problem, I think, lies in the nature of the state that we inherited, which was a colonial state. He might have been extreme in his so-called authoritarianism, but I don't think it was exceptional.
Now, what about the other side of Magufuli's legacy, that his supporters might point to, his economic nationalism, anti-imperialism? How does that fit into Tanzania's history?
I think he was economically was dealing with a problem which is also structural and historical, in the sense that the economy that we have been created, basically, they are dependent economies. Created to cater to the interest of the outside world powers. And there has been a history of resistance against external oppression as well as external exploitation, starting with the anti-colonial movement and after independence, for instance, in Tanzania in 1967, when Mwalimu Nyerere announced the Arusha Declaration, which pronounced Tanzania's policy shift towards building a socialist society. But then, you know, something happened in the 1980s when the country was forced almost at gunpoint, and I'm using this figuratively in the sense that aid and trade was used to force Tanzania to surrender to the dictates of the West. So it's in that context where Magufuli rises and he promises to restore Tanzania's lost glory, lost legacy of reclaiming its right to self-determination. He declared what he called the economic war in 2017 against mining giants. This was his biggest battle, and he enacted one of the most radical and progressive mining policies in Africa.
So on balance, then, where does that leave Tanzania after Magufuli?
There's a very huge divide in Tanzania. The middle classes of my type would say he was a dictator because he narrowed down their space for expression. But among the masses, he's the most popular president in the neoliberal era, serving Nyerere, who was the first president. And he always tried to identify himself as a person who followed Nyerere's policies. But his nationalism was different. It's a new nationalism, which was progressive in some sense and also regressive in others. So when it comes to dealing with probably neighboring countries on the question of Pan-Africanism, it was very inward-looking. And as such, it reversed some of the gains on the Pan-Africanist ideals that had been put in place under Nyerere's era.
Sabato Niamsenda is a professor at the University of Dar es Salaam. He was speaking to my colleague, Jason Patinkin. Russia held a conference on Afghanistan in Moscow Thursday. It is part of an intense diplomatic push led by the United States to jumpstart a stalled peace process. Aisha Tanzim has this update.
Thursday's Moscow conference is supposed to be the first of several focused on achieving a lasting peace in Afghanistan, one of the world's most chronically war-torn nations. Two more international conferences are expected as early as next month, one hosted by the United Nations and the other by Turkey. The hectic diplomatic activity is pushed by the United States, mainly due to fears that Afghanistan would descend into chaos if the foreign forces in the country leave without a political settlement. The U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban last year, promising a full withdrawal of foreign forces by May 1st this year. The withdrawal was supposed to be accompanied by a political settlement between the warring sides. That effort has failed so far. In his opening remarks, translated into English here, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said negotiation was the only way forward.
And it is only through diplomatic peace process, negotiations and compromise that peace can be achieved. And the agreements that are to be reached have to include the interests of all parties.
In a joint statement, conference host Russia, the U.S., and two regional powers, China and Pakistan, called on all sides to reduce violence and complete their peace negotiations. Next month's conference in Turkey aims to build on momentum from the Moscow gathering. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Water levels on the Euphrates River in northern Syria have fallen dramatically in recent weeks as Kurdish officials there accuse Turkey of reducing the volume of water flowing downstream. Turkish officials have not commented on the accusations, but say they too are experiencing water shortages. Edward Uranian reports farmers are voicing concerns about a situation that some analysts say could further destabilize the region.
Ibrahim Al-Hamadi, a farmer in the largely Kurdish region of Kobani, tries to plow his parched field in northern Syria as water levels on the nearby Euphrates River appear to be at historic low levels. Hamadi says he needs to work his fields or he will die of starvation, but water levels continue to drop. He says that areas of dry land that have appeared were once part of the river until water levels started to drop in February, leaving white silt and mud flats in some places. Abdullah, a middle-aged farmer from Hasaka, told Arab media Turkey is responsible for drying up the Euphrates River. He says that water affects man, agriculture, and nearly everything. Turkey, he maintains, is doing this. The UN, human rights groups, and the whole world, he says, need to bring the water back because water is life for man. Turkish officials told Arab media that Ankara is experiencing serious water shortages as well. Turkey in the past has temporarily reduced the river's flow during times of drought. Iraq's water minister, Mehdi al-Hamadani, recently told a water conference in Baghdad the water crisis is affecting Syria, Iraq, and other countries in the region to the point where it is damaging both the land and the environment. He said that the areas around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers have witnessed serious droughts in recent years, increasing evaporation and major environmental issues in Iraq and its neighbors. Hamid al-Hamadi, an engineer at Syria's Tashrin Dam along the Euphrates near Aleppo, complains about the falling levels of water on Lake Assad downstream. He says Syria needs a strategic water reserve for both agriculture and drinking water in addition to electrical production. The level of the lake has fallen by half, causing a crisis. Electrical engineer Ahmed Asso, who works at the Tashrin Dam's power generating plant, says that water flows from Turkey have fallen for the past 2 months from a normal 500 cubic meters to just 200 cubic meters, causing electricity shortages. He says that current water levels at the dam only allow for the production of 70 megawatts of electricity, or 10% of electricity requirements for northern Syria. Most towns in the region, he says, are getting just 6 hours of electricity per day, with blackouts of 18 hours. Farmers say groundwater aquifers are at their lowest in memory, with some warning of catastrophe for Syrian agriculture if the Euphrates remains at current levels. Observers say Turkey's hydroelectric and irrigation projects have brought stresses on water, energy, and food security in Syria and Iraq for many years. Some analysts point to drought in Syria's heartland as a leading cause for the country's decade-long civil war. Meanwhile, further downstream, Iraq has been negotiating with Turkey in recent days to try and fend off the impending water crisis on both the Tigris and the Euphrates. Turkish parliament officials say an agreement between the two countries is near. Tensions between Syria and Turkey, however, are not close to being resolved. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Before I continue, I want to make a correction to yesterday's broadcast. I inadvertently said Africa's population was about 3.3 billion, but I meant to say about 1.3 billion. I do apologize for that error. The UN Refugee Agency reports its global response to the coronavirus pandemic has largely succeeded in containing the widespread transmission of the deadly infection among refugee populations around the world. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
More than 80 million people globally have been forcibly displaced by persecution, conflict, and violence, including 26 million refugees. When the coronavirus surfaced, the UN Refugee Agency was concerned about its ability to tackle the spread of the infection, COVID-19 disease. Of particular concern was the ability to prevent the coronavirus from spreading rapidly and widely among refugees living in the far-flung, remote rural areas, and in congested refugee camps. The UNHCR's Resilience and Solutions Director, Sajad Malik, says refugees in urban areas are better able than those in rural areas to maintain social distancing, access health systems, and cope with testing and contact tracing.
We had to put in systems in place where social distancing could be practiced. We had to provide additional water in many of these locations. Remember, 15 to 20 liters per person per day in an emergency is absolutely essential, which is not even available in some places. So to bring extra water, extra hygiene for washing, and all the rest was quite a massive undertaking.
Through the generosity of international donors and development agencies, the UNHCR received $492 million in 2020, allowing the agency to pre-position large quantities of essential personal protective equipment and medical equipment. Money also was spent on general assistance programs, including livelihood support, education for children, and mental and psychosocial support. The agency has confirmed some 63,000 infections among refugees, although it acknowledges this number may be higher. The agency's Deputy Resilience and Solutions Director, Marianne Schilperut, says a major task for the coming year is to ensure refugees are included in national vaccination programs.
We know that currently 106 countries have included refugees and other and internally displaced persons in their plans, and that others are still working very hard on the inclusion of these. We are continuing to work very closely with the COVAX partners to ensure that we're able to provide this access, which is an estimated 20% by the end of this year.
COVAX is a global vaccine distribution plan that aims to deliver tens of millions of vaccine doses to low- and middle-income countries. UNHCR officials say they are not looking for preferential treatment for refugees, but add it is essential that they are not overlooked. The officials say evidence shows the inclusion of refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants in national vaccination programs benefits the entire community, whereas exclusion carries with it a heavy price. The agency is seeking $455 million to implement this year's COVID-19 Global Preparedness and Response Plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The first court appearance for the man charged with killing 8 people in a series of shootings in Atlanta, Georgia, has reportedly been canceled. The suspect was expected to be arraigned on Thursday afternoon in Cherokee County, but the Washington Post, citing the county district attorney's office, said that he waived his right to appear, doing so in writing through his attorney. Police said on Wednesday that they do not yet have a motive for the shootings, and in addition to the 6 victims of Asian descent that were killed, a white man and a white woman were also killed. Police say a 9th person remains hospitalized with injuries. Now, the crime has created a wave of fear in the Asian American community, which was already reeling from attacks that have occurred since the start of the coronavirus pandemic a year ago. Russell Jung is the co-founder of the Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate and a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswar spoke to Jung and began their conversation by asking about why the rise in charges against perpetrators isn't going up at the same rate as incidents of crimes against Asians.
The focus on hate crimes is problematic because not all police recognize it, report it, and Asian Americans themselves may not clearly are underreporting what's happening to them. We at Stop Hate are collecting the range of hate incidents that Asian Americans are dealing with. And some of them occur at schools, so you can't necessarily be arrested. We have a lot of online harassment on public spaces. We're getting coughed and spat upon. So a lot of these issues, these hateful incidents aren't necessarily crimes for which you can be arrested, but are still traumatizing events.
Hate incidents against Asian Americans is not new, right? I mean, we've had a long history in this country against Asian Americans. What do you think makes it particular or specific in terms of what Asian Americans are experiencing this year within the pandemic?
Asian Americans have long experienced racism and violent crime throughout their history. And that's why we created Stop API Hate, because we knew if an epidemic came from Asia, Asians would be scapegoated and met with interpersonal violence and racist policies. What exacerbated the racism was President Trump's political rhetoric. When he used the term Chinese virus, that hate speech went viral and it led to hate violence. So we do attribute the racism to the political rhetoric, to the pandemic, and to the historic roots of racism that have long plagued Asian Americans.
And now we see the Biden administration trying to overcome that. We do hear a lot of signals. The president is meeting with leaders, Asian American leaders. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think they're doing enough? What more needs to be done?
I think President Biden and Vice President Harris are taking right steps to meet with the victims. Clearly, it was a horrific shootings, and the way they've been treated by local authorities has been callous, insensitive, and maybe even re-traumatizing to see how the victims' lives and the families have been disregarded, whereas the perpetrator has been seen to just have a bad day, quote-unquote. So President Biden's presence in Georgia is really helpful. It demonstrates his responsiveness to the communities. And this is, again, an American issue of mass shooting, an American issue of racism, and it's an American issue of violence that he should address. It is a crisis of national proportions.
Do you think that hate incidents and hate crimes against Asian Americans are uniquely difficult or uniquely challenging to identify compared to incidents of hate against other racial groups?
I think overall, when you have a narrow definition of racism as an expression it has to be demonstrated by someone's verbal intent, right? So you have to have a slur to go along with an action. It is really difficult to ascertain whether racial bias was clear and demonstrated, or a crime was motivated by race that we were targeted. If you broaden the understanding, like in the Georgia shootings, 6 out of 8 of the individuals killed were Asian American. We suffered disproportional impact. That's a different way of looking at it. Instead of looking at, well, what was the perpetrator's intent, we look at the impact of the act. And it's clear Asian Americans have faced disproportionate impact.
Russell Jung is the co-founder of Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate and a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. He was speaking to VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara. The U.S. House of Representatives on Thursday voted to give young immigrants nicknamed Dreamers, who came to the United States illegally as children, protection against deportation and a pathway to citizenship. The AP's Mike Gracia.
On a near party line vote, the House has approved a bill offering legal status to so-called Dreamers, young people who were brought to the United States illegally as children. The bill, which passed on a 228-197 vote, would also create a path to citizenship for hundreds of thousands of migrants who were admitted to the U.S. for humanitarian reasons. On a separate vote, the House approved another measure creating similar protections for 1 million farm workers who are in the U.S. illegally. The measures now advanced to the Senate, where support from at least 10 Republicans would be needed to break GOP filibusters. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Aircraft mechanic Don Yip is one of many thousands leaving Hong Kong after the imposition of a new national security law last year and 2019's pro-democracy protests. Unlike many others, he won't leave without his pets. Reuters' Brian Wood has his story.
After China's new national security law to quell unrest and tighten control over Hong Kong, 40-year-old Don Yip decided it was time to leave, but not without his pets.
These pets are really a part of my family. I'm also emotionally attached to them. After raising them for so many years, I can't abandon them.
Yip made plans to settle in the UK after a new visa scheme for those with British national overseas passports. As part of that, Yip has spent over $14,000 getting ready to relocate his 3 fluffy huskies and cat, including transportation, vaccinations, and processing medical documents. For help, he hired a pet relocation service called Life Travel. Diana Chan is the company's founder. She says her business surged in 2019 when Hong Kong faced months of anti-government protests.
From 2017 to 2019, our business of transporting pets increased threefold. We expected it to increase because there was the social unrest.
Official numbers show a 35% increase in animal export certificates from 2018 to 2020. Animal welfare group, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, also said demand for pet microchips is now four times what it once was. Countries like the UK and Australia require them for pets coming in. Jane Gray is with the SPCA's local chapter.
Of course, it will be stressful, but the way I look at it as well, it's a short-term stressful event for maybe 24 hours when you're talking about the rest of an animal's life.
Last month, Yip, his girlfriend, and her daughter prepared their four pets to make the long journey. They carefully sealed them into kennels and said goodbye before reuniting again in the UK.
Reuters reporter Brian Wood. Now, it's been over a year now since the COVID-19 pandemic changed the way that the world does business and spends its leisure time. In Africa, the tourism sector, which during normal times employed an estimated 3 million people, has been especially hard hit. However, when it comes to the safari and ecotourism businesses, the crisis has inspired some interesting innovations that further their message of conservation. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kadu Sibwe Shabunya, the president and CEO of the Africa Wildlife Foundation. Mr. Shabunya began their conversation by describing the Zoom safaris offered by some African national parks at a time when most international visitors can't participate in physical safaris due to travel restrictions.
The Zoom safaris are phenomenal now. You sit on your fireside with a glass of wine in front of your laptop or phone, and people take you around Serengeti or Nairobi Park or Kruger National Park. We have several Land Rovers or Jeeps traveling across the park, and they're sending live footage to a central place. And the main person, the anchor, is showing you different cameras depending on what's going on.
What's the underlying rationale for the Zoom safaris?
The basic idea is to keep clients still connected to wildlife. Who knows? People who have always wanted to come to Africa, they might change their mind and say, you know what? It's too much trouble now. I can't. We cannot afford to lose that global constituency. But also it's important to put soldiers in the park as they interact with wildlife. It gives them hope. It gives them continuity. They travel the parks, and therefore they increase the eyes around the park. So it's a huge opportunity and advantage in that way.
Are you hoping that safaris will continue to be online even when travel restrictions are eased?
The last thing we want to see is becoming a substitute to travel. Travel is so important, not only seeing wildlife, but we are connecting Americans to Africans, people-to-people contact.
I know that the pandemic has widened access to the parks in other ways. Before COVID, when people always had to go to physical workplaces, they tended to come only during peak migration season, during the summer, and on holidays. Since many people are teleworking, they can now come to the parks, get online on the internet in their lodges, and then work some and safari some.
We think that actually COVID is going to turn the industry around. People will be able to take off 3 weeks during winter season because they can still work while they are in Nairobi Park, which is going to increase revenue for conservation in so many ways.
I was fascinated to learn that there are many domestic tourists now that there weren't before.
I visited Kidepo National Park 2 weeks ago. This is one of the oldest parks in Uganda. For the first time, 60% of the tourists were domestic. Normally, they receive less than 1%. So the opportunity here is that we need to develop domestic tourists. Regional tourists, too. We would like to see Zimbabweans visit Uganda, Kenyans visit Uganda, and Rwandese, and vice versa.
I understand that safari guides have actually been enjoying an enhanced role since the start of COVID.
If you know any good guide in Africa, they are phenomenal. These guys are data banks, but they've been just giving that information to international arrivals. So we are now thinking of telling stories of lions and rhinos and giraffes to Africa kids in schools. And we've been taking kids living near national parks to see wildlife physically. It's been a phenomenon.
So how would you sum up your message and approach to conservation?
It's almost like people liking wildlife more than people, or sometimes trying to protect wildlife at the expense of people. That's how Africans see it, what is happening. We must all come together as the globe to understand that conservation is not about protecting wildlife animals so that tourists can enjoy them. That's not the point. So we need to do a little bit of more explanation. It's about protecting ourselves as people from environmental degradation, such as COVID-19 pandemic has taught us right now. We must all come together as the globe to understand that conservation is not about protecting wildlife animals. The biggest priorities right now should be restoring wildlife habitats, planning development activities and infrastructure in such a way that it does not compromise environmental well-being. We are at a crossroad. Africa is deciding now its future.
That was African Wildlife Foundation President and CEO Kadu Sibwe Shabunya. And he was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.